Hello and welcome to the Westminster Institute. I'm Robert Briley, its director. Today we're very pleased to welcome a gentleman who is very well known for his trade experience and his experience in Asia. And I'm speaking of our guest, Clyde Prestowitz, who is the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He is a veteran U.S. trade negotiator and presidential advisor to Presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. Mr. Prestowitz has worked on Asia and globalization for 50 years. He was a leader of the first U.S. trade mission to China in 1982, and helped to arrive at agreements that enabled U.S. companies to establish operations in China. He is the author of many books, including Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, How Wealth and Power Are Flowing to the East, The Betrayal of American Prosperity, and Japan Restored. His most recent book is The World Turned Upside Down, America, China, and the Struggle for Global Leadership. Mr. Prestowitz has a BA with honors from Swarthmore College, an MA in East-West Policies and Economics from the East-West Center of the University of Hawaii, and an MBA from the Wharton Graduate School of Business. He also studied at Keio University in Tokyo. Mr. Prestowitz is fluent in Japanese, Dutch, German, and French. So today we are going to discuss The World Turned Upside Down, America, China, and the Struggle for Global Leadership. Clyde, welcome to the Westminster Institute.
Oh, thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Let me start toward the end of your book with a statement you make that is sure to get everybody's attention. And perhaps you could expand upon this for a moment. You say this struggle with China is, quote, the greatest challenge the United States has ever faced, short of the Civil War, unquote. That's saying a lot. That's saying it's a greater challenge than the two world wars. It's a greater challenge than the Cold War.
Yes, I think so. You know, if you think of the two world wars, they were really a slam dunk for the U.S. There was no question that we were going to win both of them. And the Cold War is more similar to the challenge that China presents. But Russia, Soviet Union, was weak by comparison to China today. It did not have advanced manufacturing that China has or that the U.S. had. It did not have the scientific and technological capability. Sure, it had nuclear weapons, but we're seeing today in Ukraine really how badly equipped the Russian or the Soviet army was at that time. And the economy of the Soviet Union was never linked. I mean, there were some links, but it was never strongly linked with the economies of the free world. And it didn't provide the kind of wages, the kind of consumer welfare, and the kind of technological advance that the free world economies did. The size of the Soviet Union's economy was never more than about half that of the U.S., leaving the EU out of it. Today, depending on how you count, China's economy is bigger than the U.S. I mean, if you use normal exchange rates, the U.S. economy is still 25% bigger than the Chinese economy. But if you use purchasing power parity, the Chinese economy is about 25% bigger than the U.S. economy. So we're talking about an economy that's a real economy of our scale, and it has developed a very good high-tech sector. It's in some sectors like semiconductors or aircraft, it's not quite as good as the U.S., but it's catching up fast. And in other areas like shipbuilding or high-speed rail, it's way ahead of the U.S., and it has a linkage to the rest of the world through the Belt and Road and those programs in which China is building high-speed rail for countries like Thailand and in Asia, in Africa rather, making big inroads. In fact, if you look at the Panama Canal, this is really striking. Look at the country of Panama and the Panama Canal, which we think of as kind of an American extension of America. Virtually everything in Panama except the canal is owned by China. It's striking. If you get a map and you know, look down at Panama and look at the industries and the real estate and the canal, they don't own the canal, but they own almost, China owns almost everything else. And of course, China is working with Nicaragua to build an alternative canal through Nicaragua. As I said, I believe China represents the biggest challenge to us since the Civil War.
When reading through your book, one word kept coming to mind, and that is naivete. The naivete on the part of the United States and other Western countries in its dealings with China based upon a very faulty assumption of what was actually in play and what the nature of the Chinese regime was and is, that becoming far clearer today. But one of the most impressive things about your book is the detailed history you give of this. And one keeps shaking one's head as you go into those details of how we could have so deluded ourselves. And you give chapter and verse, and you quote a lot of U.S. trade officials, presidents, and so forth, in statements which they should be quite embarrassed today at having been made. And that, of course, includes Henry Kissinger. I want to just offer one statement and then hear you comment upon that. I was a foot soldier in the Cold War with the Soviet Union. I served in several different government agencies to engage in that, on the U.S. side of that Cold War. Today, the general opinion is in the United States, we won the Cold War. Well, who was we? Because during that time, as you well know, there was quite a division of opinion in the United States as to the nature of the Soviet Union and how to deal with it, and most particularly how seriously to take its Marxist-Leninist ideology. And a great part of the foreign policy establishment, many think tanks, said, no, that's just a front for traditional Russian geopolitical interests. You look at those, don't take the ideology seriously. Some of that seemed to be a carryover from having the Soviet Union as an ally in World War II. And the United States seems incapable of having an ally or even a solid relationship with a country without presenting that country to itself as a friend, or Joseph Stalin as Uncle Joe, until right. We were finally disabused of that. Is it accurate to say that that sort of indigenous incapability in the United States played into the misunderstanding and the relationship of China? It must be our friendly competitor and not an adversary.
Yeah, I think, you know, we kind of wanted China to be friendly and open and kind of like us. And what we really missed, I really blame this on our China scholars and China experts, what we really missed was an understanding of the true nature of the Chinese Communist Party. We didn't grasp that the Chinese Communist Party is not only a communist party, but a Leninist party, that what it seeks above all else is power, and that it is diametrically opposed and has always been diametrically opposed to the values that we as Americans and as citizens of the free world feel are fundamental. And I think that on the one hand, we had a long Cold War with the Soviet Union. And during that time, of course, for the first part of that period, China under Mao Zedong was with the Soviets. And then Kissinger and Nixon did the kind of realignment with China in 1972, 1978, 79. Then when the Soviet Union collapsed and Deng Xiaoping had taken over, and Deng said to get rich is glorious. We really wanted, you know, we're tired of the Cold War. We were tired of constant conflict with the Soviet Union. And we really wanted China to be fuzzy and nice and develop its economy. And we had a faith that the economic interaction would stimulate a shift not only in China's economic policies, but also in its broader human rights and political policies. I think there's another factor. One was wishful thinking. I think a big factor, honestly, was George H.W. Bush, whom I loved and admired. I worked for him for a while. I thought he was a great guy. But after Tiananmen Square, when the Chinese, we don't really know how many students they killed, but the low number is 500 or 600. And when that happened, you know, you might have imagined that Bush would have been shocked and that he would have really cracked down on further American investment in China or trade with China, or that he would have set some conditions for China, that if it wanted to continue trading with the U.S. and taking advantage of the economies of the free world, it had to dramatically change its human rights policies. But instead of that, Bush sent Brent Scowcroft, his national security advisor, immediately the next day to Beijing. And the message basically was, don't worry, George Bush is your best friend, and he'll keep the boats from rocking. Now, I've scratched my head, I can't tell you how much. Why did Bush react that way? And I really don't know, but I suspect it was because Bush had been ambassador to China before he became president. And he seemed to have fallen in love with the Chinese staff that staffed his home and the embassy. And he had a soft spot in his heart for China. And he may have had other strategic considerations. But in any case, Bush wasn't alone in this. If you remember, Frank Fukuyama famously wrote a book called The End of History when the Soviet Union collapsed. And obviously, Frank was not paying any attention to China. Or if he was, he thought China was going to become democratic and free trading and capitalist. And so, you know, our top leaders and our top scholars, I think they wished for China to become what they wanted it to become, and it was presented that way. It wasn't like there's no warning signals. I mean, in 1992, when China was, I can tell you, China was really poor. I went to China, I led the first trade mission to China in 1982, and I have never seen such poverty. 1992 was better than 82, but it was still a poor country. And yet, it decided to develop its own geostrategic satellite positioning system like the U.S. and like the Galileo system in Europe. But the real signal in my mind that what should have shaken Western leaders was the creation of the Great Firewall. This is 1997. China separated the internet, the Chinese internet, from the World Wide Web. That was a clear, you know, declaration of war. It was a clear declaration by the Chinese Communist Party that they were going to control information. They were not going to let anything from the West seep into the garden they had created in China. Bill Clinton's reaction was, ha, 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 let them try. It'll be like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. They won't be able to control the internet. Well, ha, 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 they did and they do. And then, you know, in 2012, document nine, number nine on the ideological sphere was released. And in this document, the Chinese Communist Party clearly, directly spells out that it rejects the notion of human rights. It rejects the notion of universal rights. It rejects free speech. It rejects the notion of election, fair elections. I mean, everything that the West stands for, the Chinese Communist Party clearly spelled out they object to it. They don't agree with it. They oppose it. Nobody paid attention to that. 2015, China announces Made in China 2025. And they published a list of all the high-tech industries, semiconductors, telecommunications, biotech, et cetera. So all of the leading cutting-edge technologies of the future, China said publicly to everybody, we're going to make this stuff in China, and we're going to do it all by 2025. And so that was a clear declaration that China didn't really believe in free trade, that it was going to subsidize its own industries, try to obtain technology by hook or by crook in the West, and effectively squeeze Western companies out of those industries, in China at least. So, you know, it wasn't like we didn't have warning. It was just that our leaders, our economists were in love with globalization. Our journalists, people like Tom Friedman of the New York Times, famously wrote a book called The World is Flat. Our journalists joined with our economists in promoting globalization, interdependence, the notion being that through globalization, I mean, George W. Bush made this comment that free trade would automatically plant the seeds of democracy. So there was just a lot of self-deception in American policy, and it was on the part of the elite of the U.S. These weren't stupid people. These were the people, you know, in the Ivy League and in the Washington intellectual world, bright, smart, well-educated people, fooling themselves.
It seems that that statement you just made about how the free market will transform China politically into a free society and regime is a form of free market economic determinism.
Yeah, yes.
That parallels, you know, Marxist economic determinism.
Right.
I also want our viewers to be sure to know that you trace the terrible consequences of these illusions or delusions regarding the nature of the Chinese Communist Party back to the end of World War II and the behavior of General George Marshall, who everyone agrees was a great American hero in many respects, but made that fatal mistake in buying Mao Zedong's portrayal of himself as an agrarian reformer and forcing Chiang Kai-shek into both an alliance with him and then to stop him from a military action, which most likely would have spelled the end of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as the Soviet Union's behavior of its continuing incursion into China after the war was over, getting, I think you said, down to within 50 miles of Beijing, and then turning over those territories to the communists, and still we didn't seem to catch on.
Yeah, no, we, you know, as you said, we revered George Marshall as a great man, and the Marshall Plan that resurrected Europe certainly was a giant stroke. But Marshall totally blew it on China. But I would say that, you know, well, a lot of other people were also involved. I mean, during World War II, the president of China was Chiang Kai-shek, who governed having won elections under as the Nationalist Party, Kuomintang. And Chiang made this interesting comment once. He said that the Japanese were like a disease of the skin, but that the communists were a disease of the heart. Before World War II, before the Japanese invaded, there was conflict between the communists and the nationalists. And Chiang, by 1933, Chiang Kai-shek had pretty much defeated the Communist Party in most of China. And in fact, the communists were forced to make what they call the Great March. And you remember that Mao began with like 85,000 of his followers in southwest China, and in the course of a year, they moved, they marched, they walked to northeast China. What I find interesting about that walk is that Mao didn't walk. He was carried on a caravan chair, But he arrived at Yan'an, where his final destination, the 85,000 had shrunk to 10,000. So Chiang Kai-shek was in pretty good control of China. But then in 1935, the Japanese began their invasion, and Chiang was forced to deal with the Japanese. And they were, of course, much better armed and much better organized than the Chinese. So in the course of the war, we think of the war beginning in 1941, but for the Chinese, it began in 1935. And during that period, the Japanese pushed Chiang Kai-shek into the far west of China. What we don't think about too much is that after Pearl Harbor, we, of course, went fully to war with Japan, but we were not in any kind of direct contact with the Chinese. Japan was occupying most of China. So for us to get to Chiang Kai-shek and to get supplies to Chiang Kai-shek, we had to fly over what's called the hump, over the Himalaya Mountains, just to supply him. We sent General Stilwell to be an advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. Stilwell was known as Vinegar Joe. I mean, even American soldiers found him a very difficult guy. He had the advantage that he spoke Chinese, which is, I guess, why he was sent to work with Chiang Kai-shek. But he detested Chiang Kai-shek, and Chiang came to detest him also. So it wasn't a happy relationship. But during the war, Chiang Kai-shek tied down 2 to 3 million Japanese soldiers who otherwise would have been available to fight against the U.S. in the Pacific campaign. And anyhow, we won the war, Japanese surrendered, and the communists had really not done much fighting against the Japanese. Their strategy was to lie low and let the Japanese decimate Chiang Kai-shek's army. They were supported by the Russians. And then once the Japanese surrendered, the big race came on who was going to take the surrender of the Japanese. And the Russians under Uncle Joe Stalin rushed weapons and trucks and everything to Mao to enable him to take surrender in the northwest of China near Beijing. We delayed. Somehow we couldn't seem to get the airplanes and the ships to Chiang Kai-shek to enable him in time to get to North China. Anyhow, long story short, we never really gave Chiang Kai-shek the support that he needed, in my view. But then we get to 1947, 48, and George Marshall, who had been Secretary of State, was asked by President Truman to go to China. A great man though he was, George Marshall knew nothing about China and certainly nothing about the animosity between the Chinese communists and the Chinese nationalists. And his idea was to have a coalition government to get Mao and Chiang Kai-shek to work together in a coalition government to rule China. And it just wasn't going to happen. But Marshall had a strong weapon to force Chiang to do what he wanted because we were supplying Chiang's army substantially. The Russians were supplying Mao. And Marshall threatened he would cut off supplies to Chiang Kai-shek if Chiang didn't agree to a coalition government. So Chiang did agree, under pressure, of course, but it didn't work. It totally didn't work. The fighting continued, and we sent other generals to China to study the situation. But bottom line is, we didn't really support Chiang Kai-shek in his contest with Mao Zedong, and Mao won. And so here we are.
One thing that at first puzzled me was why in so many chapters of the book, you have chapter headings which are quotes from scripture. And then I reached the statement you made that helped me understand exactly why you did that, and it made complete sense. I'm quoting you here. One may think of Xi as the Pope of the Chinese anti-church and of the party as a theocracy with the goal of creating a hegemonic China that will become a kind of heaven on earth. So I think you very acutely diagnose the nature of the Chinese Communist Party as a pseudo-religion.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely essential to understand what the Chinese Communist Party is really all about. Unfortunately, in the West, we no longer take religion very seriously. But I don't think you can properly understand the Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping. If you think of the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, or think of the orders of the Catholic Roman Catholic Church, the Jesuit order of the Roman Catholic Church, and the deep commitment to a particular faith or way of thought. That's how you have to see Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, which means that, the U.S. idea that, if we get engaged in free trade, free markets will loosen this system and cause it to change. Well, no, they won't, because the system doesn't, it's not going to allow free markets to get in the way of what the system was, what the faith insists upon. If you think about, through closer ties and coupling with China, economic coupling with China, that will moderate and loosen up. And it won't, because above all, the Chinese Communist Party aims to maintain power. It's all about power. Everything else is secondary. So if you don't understand that, I don't think you can in any adequately deal with dealing with China. It's an anti-religion.
Which helps explain the reason for religious persecution in China.
Yeah. I mean, there's another element here involved as well. When we speak of China, we don't even think about this, but what we mean is we mean Han Chinese. So there are a lot of different minorities in Chinese. You've got the Uyghurs, got the Mongolians, the Han. Over centuries, the Han have expanded so that today, probably 90% of China are Han Chinese. Tibetans are not Han Chinese. Uyghurs are not Han Chinese. But what you've seen over centuries, and particularly what we're seeing since the communists gained control of China, is suppression of the minority ethnic groups in China. And so we're aware today of the suppression of the Uyghurs because of the extreme measures that Chinese have taken. But if you look at Tibet, it has been Hanified. The Chinese not only gained control of Tibet, but they began sending Han Chinese as immigrants to Tibet. So the population of Tibet today is probably less than half Tibetan. Mongolia is very interesting. You have Inner and Outer Mongolia. So Inner Mongolia is part of China. Outer Mongolia is an independent country. But in Inner Mongolia, just in the last few years, the government of China has required that the schools be taught in Mandarin. So the Mongolian language is being suppressed in Inner Mongolia because the kids are all being taught in Mandarin. And the same kind of colonization is taking place in Inner Mongolia of putting Han Chinese there. So, not only is China a dictatorship and, as I said, committed to a kind of an anti-religion, but it's racist. And this is something I find... it's funny, but it's sad. We in America are tearing ourselves apart because we're talking about inequality and racism in America. The United States is like the least racist country that I've dealt with in my life. And China is a hugely racist country, but nobody ever talks about it. It's just ironic.
Let's get back to the Marxist side of the Marxism-Leninism evident in the Chinese Communist Party. Kevin Rudd, the former Australian Prime Minister and the president of the Asia Society, I think is one of the most insightful thinkers on China, a Mandarin speaker, as you know. And he makes this observation about the recently concluded 20th Party Congress in China. And referring to the report on the Party Congress, he says the term Marxism itself is referred to 26 times in the work report, double the number that we saw in the already ideologized report of 2017. The Marxist-Leninist concept of struggle as a means by which to realize domestic or international progress against the party's stated objectives has 22 references, and so forth. Now, in your book, you quote a Communist Party leader, Chen Yun, as saying this, quote, "We are the Communist Party, and we will decide what communism is," unquote. So that's the intriguing question. Anyone who has been to China looks around, and if one compares it to one's experiences in the Soviet Union, you clearly immediately think to yourself, well, this isn't Marxism-Leninism as we knew it there. So something is different here. So how is the party defining communism for itself today?
Well, as you know, whenever they discuss this, they talk about Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. And so I think the quote you made is very apropos. Chinese communism is what the Chinese communists say it is. And Xi is the biggest Chinese communist with the biggest stick. And he's telling everybody what it is. What I find fascinating is that I think now most experts, analysts, and leaders in the free world have concluded that Xi Jinping is a true believer. He takes Marxism seriously. He analyzes issues in Marxist terms and framework. But it took people a long time to understand that. And for a long time, you know, when Xi first came into office, there was a feeling in the free world that, hey, this is, he's a younger guy and somebody that we can really work with. I had no idea that he was going to be another Mao, but he is. And so I think, you know, communism with Chinese characteristics is what Xi Jinping says it is.
You imply that the fall of the Soviet Union sent tremendous shockwaves through the Communist Party of China.
Yeah, it did. And Xi has spent a lot of time and a lot of effort and money on trying to understand what happened to the Soviet Communist Party. I think, you know, his greatest fear is that the same thing could happen for the Chinese Communist Party. And he has really tried very, very hard to understand what happened to the Soviet communists. Why did they suddenly fall apart? I'm not sure he understands it, but to the extent that he does, he will take all measures to prevent it.
Which primarily seems to have included a reinvigoration of the ideology.
Yeah.
And ensuring that party members are thoroughly indoctrinated in it and engage in the doublespeak that's necessary with this ideological worldview, which also, Clyde, you point out very presciently, contains the idea of a continuous state of struggle. Complete that thought. Were it not for the existence of the United States or something similar, the Communist Party of China would have no reason to exist. So they have to think of themselves as Marxist-Leninists as being in this continuous state of struggle. Is that right?
I think that's right. Yeah. I think a Leninist party is always scared to death of losing power. So Everything has to be, watched carefully. Cadres have to be tested and retested to prove that they're true believers. And we've seen it in the Soviet Union, and we see it in China, that factions arise because obviously some people are beginning to think a little bit differently, and then there's conflict, and the leaders do their best to cut it off, tamp it down, surveil it. It's a brutal, I myself wonder, why does anyone want to join this party? Why does anyone want to be a Communist Party leader? Because, man, it is brutal and unforgiving. And just think about the number of people that Xi Jinping has thrown in jail or killed. It's just unbelievable. I have a friend, Jimmy Lai, who was a publisher in Hong Kong. He's in jail, gonna die in jail. Xi Jinping basically put him there. For why? Well, because he didn't believe in the Communist Party. And so, it's really a very unforgiving system.
And Cardinal Zen is in jail too.
Yeah, Cardinal Zen is in jail. And, you're probably aware that right now, a number of Wall Street kingpins are in Hong Kong celebrating the opening of Hong Kong from COVID and talking about how great the Hong Kong market is going to be and the recovery of Hong Kong. And they're all speaking next to this guy, John Lee, who is the guy who put Jimmy Lai in jail. He's a puppet for Xi Jinping. It just really, really gets me upset to see influential American leaders paying homage to that kind of thing, but they do. Or, let's take a company like Apple. We call it an American company. It's not. It's chartered in the United States. But I can tell you that Tim Cook in Washington is a powerful player. He has instant entree to anybody in Washington. Apple spends millions, maybe billions of dollars every year on lobbyists and influencing Washington. In China, Tim is on his knees. He has no clout. He does what the Chinese want. And I give you just a good contrast. In 2015, there was a shooting in Bakersfield, California, and the shooter dropped his iPhone. The FBI got the iPhone and asked Apple to open it. They wanted to get the information, and Apple absolutely refused. It went to court, but before the court settled, the FBI found an expert who could open the iPhone. So the court case was left unsettled. Fast forward to 2019, and students are demonstrating in Hong Kong. There's an app in the Apple App Store called Hong Kong Map Live. So with that app, you can see Hong Kong in real time. The kids were using it, and they were looking at the map, and they said, oh, the police are over here. Oh, well, we'll go over here. Well, this was driving Beijing crazy. The People's Daily began running a huge publicity campaign against that app and against Apple. And within 2 days, that app was out of the app store. So that tells you where Tim Cook stands. And it's not just Tim. American businesses, General Electric, FedEx, lots of the high-tech companies have put big investment in China. They've transferred big technology to China. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the U.S.-China Business Council, we call them American lobbying groups. They're not. They're Beijing lobbying groups. And we really need to, my feeling is that the United States needs to recognize that its own business leaders are captive. They're hostage. They're not really acting in the best interests of the United States.
You point out that Hollywood has fallen victim to this as well.
Yeah.
And we know that Disney releases different versions of movies than they release in the United States.
Yeah.
So not to offend the Chinese Communist
Party. Yeah, or, you know, take the basketball coach. Remember last year or so, the basketball coach, the Houston Rockets, tweeted on behalf of the demonstrators in Hong Kong. And immediately, NBA games stopped being televised in China. The NBA warned its coaches to not tweet. So, I mean, we're supposed to be the country of free speech, but the NBA can't have free speech because it might cost them $1 billion in the China market. It's really corrupt.
The extent of surveillance within China of its own citizens seems to have reached an Orwellian state.
China spends more money on internal security than it does on its army and navy. It has two defense budgets. One defense budget is aimed at the outside world, and the other defense budget is aimed at inside China.
So the Chinese people are even a bigger enemy than the United States.
Potentially they are, yes.
To the party.
Right.
I note in the news also, Clyde, remarks about the what are called the Chinese service stations in various countries. The Dutch government recently ordered China to remove the service, so-called service stations that China represents as being present there to help Chinese citizens renew driver's license and other things.
Yeah.
But what in fact they're doing is threatening those citizens to fall in line with the Communist Party line by saying your relatives in China will be in danger if you continue doing or saying these things. So it's an exercise of control, even in Western countries.
Yeah.
And perhaps
this is not widely recognized, but in the United States, take an example, in the not very distant past, there were a lot of Chinese language newspapers in New York, in San Francisco, around the United States. Those newspapers are all owned now by Chinese communist organs. Australia, similar thing. There were a number of Chinese language Australian newspapers. They also were independent. They've all been captured by the party. And interestingly, this gets back again to this issue of racism. The Chinese Communist Party doesn't understand, you know, the notion of a Chinese American. If you're Chinese, you can't be anything except Chinese in their view. And so on the one hand, they look to the immigrant Chinese community as a mechanism through which they can observe the West, the US, Australia, other countries, but also they look upon those people as they try to make them captive. So, I mean, everything in China is about coercion. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the US about, because of some of the measures that President Biden and President Trump have taken, some people feel that Chinese students in the U.S. are less welcome or that they're being discriminated against. What's not well understood is that the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, watches those students. And sure, most of the students are innocent and just here to get an education. But they're being watched. They're being disciplined. And some of them are being used. It's just a fact. It's not a matter of being prejudiced. It's just you have to wake up to reality.
Which brings up the subject of the Confucius Institutes.
Oh, yeah.
And the
Confucius Institutes, yeah. Confucius would gag if he knew what they were. It's just, but again, they're everything, you know, the party attempts to politicize and control everything. And the institutes are just another outreach. You know, one of the major elements of the Chinese Communist Party is the United Front. I mean, from the beginning of communists, even Lenin, the strategy is have a united front. So find all of the other political elements out there, and to the extent that you can, try to use them and make them part of your front so that you might look much bigger and more powerful than maybe you really are. And the United Front part of the Communist Party is big and heavily funded, and it particularly watches overseas Chinese, tries to coerce them and use them in various ways. And I mean, take an example here in Washington, D.C. I'm sure you've seen it. The Washington Post periodically will carry an insert of the China Daily. That insert is being paid for by the United Front Working Commission of the Chinese Communist Party. I've written letter after letter to the Washington Post asking them why they want to become a propaganda outlet for the Chinese Communist Party. And, you know, obviously the Post is not doing well financially and it wants to make money, and that's one way they do it. But it's dishonest, and it's lending themselves to the Chinese Communist Party.
One can almost say that generally about media, can you not? I mean, they're allowed to do things within the United States and Western countries that they would not allow Western media to do inside
Absolutely.
Of China.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a lot of Chinese media in America. Right now in China, Keith Bradcher of the New York Times, I think, is like the last reporter for a major American, maybe even a major Western newspaper in China. The Financial Times doesn't have anybody. The Washington Post doesn't have anybody. The Wall Street Journal doesn't have anybody. So yeah, it's pretty sad.
You give examples of Chinese infiltration into various countries and societies. And one of the most compelling are the details you give on Australia, the extent to which financial corruption or money was used to infiltrate the society and the political order through payments and gifts and trips. All the other things we've been discussing, to the point that Australia eventually woke up and said that these foreign payments, meaning mainly China, were creating, and I'm quoting, a threat to our sovereignty, the integrity of our national institutions, and the exercise of our citizens' rights, unquote.
Yeah, no, the Aussies have begun to wake up, but it took them a long time. China, go back 10, maybe more, maybe 15 years, the Chinese targeted both Australia and Canada as societies that they could easily infiltrate and use them to kind of undercut or turn against the U.S. And of course, both those countries are part of the so-called Five Eyes intelligence collaboration of the Anglo countries. And, you know, Australia was wide open, relatively small, big physically, but 27, 28 million people, you know, about the size of Shanghai in population, with a big Chinese community. And so the party, the Chinese government, put together an extensive plan, which is still being pursued, to infiltrate and penetrate Australia. And it took the Australia, they have begun to wake up, but it took the Australians a long time to catch on. And to be honest, I think Canada is in similar shape. I'm not sure the Canadians have recognized it as much as the Aussies have.
Well, at least they just recently ordered China to divest itself of several Canadian mining companies.
They have. Share. That's a very good point. But you know, take Australia. I mean, half of the communications infrastructure in Australia is owned by Chinese state-owned companies. Several of the ports are owned by Chinese state-owned corporations. So the penetration is enormous. And Kevin Rudd certainly gets it. And other Aussie leaders have begun to get it as well. But it's very dangerous.
And Germany has just agreed to sell a large minority share in its port facilities in Hamburg. So
right.
Not everyone.
I don't know what Scholz thinks he's doing. You know, Angela Merkel really, really made big mistakes in her dealings with the Russians and the Chinese. And Schultz seems to be kind of caught in between. I'm glad, frankly, to see that Schultz is getting a lot of criticism in Germany over that Costco decision. And I'm hoping that the Germans will become more aware of how vulnerable they are. But what's going to happen, I think, is this. So the big German auto companies, BMW and Mercedes, VW, have put a lot into China. What's going to happen, I believe, is that they increasingly will lose market share in China. Or they may maintain the German name, but the production, all the work and value is going to be done by Chinese. And the German companies will find that they're on the short end of the stick. They haven't woken up to that yet, but they will. Maybe late in the game. And so I think already a lot of German companies are seeing the writing on the wall. The auto companies, not yet.
Your book is a startling wake-up call. Does the general situation leave you as a pessimist or an optimist in this?
I'm in between, I guess. I think that the U.S. Has certainly begun to wake up. The Biden administration, particularly with its semiconductor policy, I think is moving in the right direction. And I think that I even saw an article by Joe Nye this morning kind of apologizing for past innocence about China. So I'm beginning to feel that the U.S. is getting it. It's hard for the U.S. to be organized, though. As I said, we got these Wall Street giants who are in Hong Kong today. We are a free country, and it's very hard to organize the United States. And so I think we're moving in the right direction, but we still have quite some way to go. Interestingly, the Japanese and the Aussies and certainly the Taiwanese and the South Koreans have become much more unified with the U.S. So I'm somewhat encouraged. But, you know, this is not the time to declare victory. We have a long fight road ahead.
Clyde, we want to thank you for joining us at the Westminster Institute today. And I want to encourage our audience to go to the Westminster Institute website, where you'll see our other speakers on the subject of China and other topics such as Ukraine, Russia, the Middle East. Where you'll see our offerings on our own YouTube channel and our publications. Thank you for joining us today on the subject of Clyde Prestowitz's new book, The World Turned Upside Down, America, China, and the Struggle for Global Leadership. I'm Robert Riley.